There were 16 cage fights in Ireland last year. 16 fighting events. Spectators varied from 200 to 9,000. A few weeks ago, he said in his piece, two 17-year-olds fought at an event with no cage-side doctor. Two 17-year-olds fought at an event with no cage-side doctor. There is no regulation going on at the moment. In events where doctors are present, the promoters who run the shows, who are paying for the doctors, decide if they have one doctor or two. They decide, the people who are paying. In other words, fighter safety here is determined by commercial promoters. So the conflict of interest here is very, very stark and very, very worrying. For instance, the Health Safety Authority is actually legally powerless here to enforce any safety standards for fighters in the cage. But believe it or not, if someone outside the ring, an employee of the hall, were to slip, then the Health Safety Authority would have some grounds to come in and see where certain standards are being met. What we have here in what is a very dangerous sport is complete limbo.
That's correct. And it's something that I'm very, very concerned about. And I have to say that, you know, you mentioned Dan Healy, Professor Dan Healy, and he's somebody that I have met on many occasions and have spoken to him within the last month again. And in fact, he wants to meet me and I will be meeting him. Actually, well, I had to be intended to meet him this week and I will be meeting him in the next couple of days. But that's, you know, I have to, you know, just put my own case, my own record on the line here as well. Mm-hmm. In the 20th of February 2014, before this event ever happened at all, I wrote to 17 people. I wrote to 17 organisations. And these were commercial operators that were running for profit events in Ireland. And I wrote to the 17 of them, and I outlined to them that I expected the same kind of standards, safety standards that existed for other sports, such as rugby, horse racing, and professional boxing. You know, that I expected them that they would abide by the same standards. I am concerned, and I have been concerned, and I've been concerned about the growth of the sport and the way that it's unregulated. Of course, this needs to be regulated. And I want to make this quite clear, you know, that I personally, you know, wouldn't be the biggest fan of the sport. And they know that, and I've made that clear to them. But at the same time, this sport is taking place. There's a great interest in the sport. There's a lot of people turning up to these events. And there has to be some regulation put in place. How that regulation is going to be put in place, I don't know. That's something that I will discuss with my officials. That's something I will discuss with the Sports Council. In fact, I contacted John Tracy 3 weeks ago in relation to another event that was taking place, and probably the event that you're talking about there. And I was quite concerned about that event being held in a stadium in this country. And I asked that he would contact the operators at that stadium and that he make it quite clear to them. And I sent a copy of the letter that I sent to the 17 organisers in 2014 that these operators would know the standards that was expected of them. I have concerns, grave concerns, and I did predict something what happened this week would happen, and it did happen. And it's something now that we need to deal with quickly, we need to deal with speedily, and this is a sport that's grown, and it's one that, you know, that I have major concerns about myself.
Mm-hmm. I must say, I've never been at any of these events, to be honest. Conor McGregor and the UFC is the extent of my knowledge of the sport. So I haven't attended these. I'm working off what people like Professor Dan Healy have said about them. So, for instance, just in the last couple of months, events have been organised by companies like Underdog Extreme Championships, Battle Zone, Evolution Fighting Championship, Fight Pit, Irish Amateur Combat Challenge. They're all over the place. So when you write these 17 letters, what response do you get, if any? Because again, the conflict of interest here is so glaring and so dangerous that they can look at your letter and say, yeah, grand. And I put it to you that we should have been acting here a long time ago.
Well, look, we should and we shouldn't. I mean, the situation is, this is not a recognised sport. It's not recognised by the Sports Council. It hasn't been funded by government.
Why is that then? Can we explain that to me? Because,
well, I can't explain that to you because...
But Minister, for instance, just in December last year, you told The Star, Conor McGregor's been an inspiration. It's a sport that's really taken off here. If he wants to defend his title in Ireland, I'd love to see him here at Croke Park or any other stadium that's available. This is a sport. You recognise this as a sport. You're talking about Conor McGregor.
No, the question that was asked to me at the time, would I have any objection for this event taking place?
It sounds to me like you were right behind it there.
No, that's not correct. In fact,
so did you not see it as a sporting event then?
he asked me the question, would I go to it myself? And I said, no, it's not a sport that I would be a fan of.
You
and
said, I would like to see him in Croke Park. This notion that it's not recognised as a sport, you're on record as the Minister for Sport in December saying you'd like to see Conor McGregor fight at Croke Park. So it's either a sport or it's not a sport, and we deal with it accordingly.
Wouldn't give any of it away. It was absolutely fantastic, the whole build-up.
Yeah. Legend would have it that Michael Yee lads were too laid back to even care about the fact it was North Ireland. Sure, maybe a few drinks Saturday night, give out a smoke that morning.
Yeah, well, we probably had one or two doing that. But, you know, it's something, I suppose, that really kind of annoys me about my time with Offaly, is that sort of a caricature that the Offaly team had. You know, it was fed by one or two players.
Pilkington
in particular, yeah. he's a complex, brilliant character and man. But what a player he was. And this is what annoys me. I think, I've said this to him, he hasn't done himself any favours as a hurler, because he was an incredible player. He won two minor Irelands, he won two senior, he won four Ireland clubs, he won seven Leinster clubs, he won 11 Offaly senior championships. I played with him, I came in before him and I finished just before him, but I played with him for about 12 or 13 years. And he never missed a training session, he never missed a match, challenge match, Walsh Cup match or championship match in my time. And I never saw him going uninjured in a match, ever. He wouldn't give in to any man. But yet he gave this impression that he didn't care and he was smoking and drinking and blah, blah, blah. And it's the way he was an individual. You were allowed, I was talking to you, DJ, earlier about this. That's gone now. You can't be a character or a personality. But he was one of the most serious hurling people I've ever come across. And that team that I played with was full of those. The Martin Hannemies, the Keenans, Kevin Martin, the Brian Whelan, obviously Whelan, the great player, but the Dooleys, all that, John Try, serious men. But we knew how to enjoy ourselves as well, which I think that balance is gone in the game now. We had unbelievable crack. But when it came to, I said this recently. I'd say every other player in the country would love to have played with Offaly. It was brilliant. But if you take it through the 90s, I started in 86, 87. We played in three Leinster. We won three Leinsters in a row, 88, 90. If that was now, can you imagine?
Yeah.
But from the 90s, you bet us 92 and 3 by a couple of points. Savage matches. You won both All-Irelands. 94, we won the All-Ireland. 95, we were beaten in the final by Clare. 96, Wexford beat us in the Great Leinster final. They won the All-Ireland. 97, Wexford went 10 or 11 up early, and we came back. Fitzgerald made a brilliant save at the end.
Don't mention 98, right?
Yeah. 98, we won. 99, we were bet by Cork in a brilliant semi-final. They went on and won the final. And 2000, we were back in the final again. It's lovely to win All-Ireland is special, but to play it the way we played, and its skill and the enjoyment and the fun we had, I think it makes it very special for that group that we had, because we loved every minute of it. It was brilliant.
Like at that time, Joe, I mean, talk about characters. I mean, every team had characters. Like 2000 All-Ireland final, Willie O'Connor broke his ribs before the game. Now, obviously, no one can tell whether Philip broke his ribs or not, but he got a fair old thump. And he was on the bed getting injected, and Brian Cody sent out for Sean Mealy. And Sean comes in and he said, Bun was his name, Bun, you're going in for Willie. And Willie gets up off the bed and he used a few choice words and basically said, oh, Cody, he said, if you think I'm coming off, he said, take me off if you think I'm playing bad, but if it's an injury, I'm not. And he was gone out to dressing room before Cody had given the speech to go out against Offaly. And the first two balls that came near, he was out like a shot and got the ball. Nowadays, there's paperwork done before a game even starts as to who's coming off 5 minutes into the second half, or do you know what I mean? It's all down to a T now. So no one could say that nowadays, but Willie was gone out how the dressing room and the first two balls.
How does Cody respond to being told to off?
I'd say he doesn't respond too well
I
now.
I don't think so, no. And how does Pilkington respond when you tell him he did himself no favours?
I just tell you were no good and don't even talk to me about it. How would you know? Why would you know about it? There's no talking to him about anything, right? I'll tell you one quick story. Cool Derry, which would be the arch rivals of a lot of clubs in Offaly, and Burr were the great champions, and they had won in their prime. They won six Offaly championships, and they were going for seven, and Cool Derry stopped them, beat them in the county final. And Johnny had the pub in Burr, he still has. The lads were all going into the pub saying, "Will we win on Sunday?" Johnny wouldn't even talk to them. He wouldn't even look at certain, and he said, he said, you won't win on Sunday. You couldn't win. He said, you're not good enough. You haven't the skill. You haven't this. You haven't abused them anyway to the last. So these didn't win the match anyway. So Kildare are now Leinster club champions. So the whole of Kildare was in the pub that night. Johnny's not silly, stupid, I don't know, like, but the whole place, the place is packed anyway, and Johnny's in, never said well done, thanks, anything. He's in pulling pints and serving the pints, and next thing, someone had a good few pints on board, someone said, well, Johnny, it's not that hard to win a Leinster club after all, is it? Obviously not, said Johnny, but it's hard enough to win seven.
Yes, and you make the point that the physical precision of your foot on a Formula One car pedal is beyond minute. So
yeah, paramount.
Paramount. So even just the slightest feathering, the slightest lifting up, just to preserve yourself, that touch, that could be one-tenth of a second, which is a lifetime in Formula One. How exhausting is that? To force yourself...
Yeah, I mean, I reckon you're a good quality race car driver because, I mean, it is mentally taxing, exhausting. And also, every time you go through the corner and it's good, you know, when you're a perfectionist, say, oh, damn, I could have gone through just that little bit more.
Yeah.
And so you're pushing it all the time, pushing it. But then it's not as easy as that. That sounds easy to say you're pushing it, because next time you come round into that corner, you know, Harry Flat, as we used to call it, or try to, then all of a sudden the self-preservation chip comes in and your foot lifts off the throttle, and you don't mean to, but your brain's saying, oh, your foot's got to come off the throttle, because if you don't, you're going to kill yourself. So you have to then have this fight with your brain going into the corner, going, I'm going to keep my foot flat down, keep it flat down, you know, and then, you know, you're actually not paying attention to the corner because you're trying to stop your brain from picking your foot up on the throttle.
Yeah. So all your attention almost is on your on your foot. When you're driving a car ever, your brain, I presume, works at unbelievable speeds. Like, do your kids ever flash into your mind even for a millisecond in those moments?
Yeah, they all sorts of things can, because what great race car drivers can do, they slow speed down. So the fastest I've ever gone in a straight line, Indianapolis going into turn one, is 250 miles an hour. But 250 miles an hour, when everything's balanced and everything's going well, feels probably about 40 to 50 miles an hour. It gives you plenty of time to turn in. Yeah. The problem is, if something goes wrong, it feels like then 2,000 miles an hour.
Yes.
And then all hell break loose. So it's quite an extraordinary little finite balance there.
You talk, I mean, it's. I can only imagine what it's like to go through it. Gilles Villeneuve, who's a great friend of yours, someone you get on with, you chat for hours, and in Belgian qualifying, essentially you have the horrible experience of watching him die. He's thrown 50 metres out of his car. The shock, how you deal with that mentally. Counselling is not a big thing, you're a strong man, but that takes a toll. It can only take a toll, and that shock was with you for some time.
I think the shock's even with us even today. Now you mention it again, and you know it's something that you just have to get by. I mean the drivers of the past were true gladiators, and it was part of the job. And as horrible as it was, the realization, and I think that's why a lot of drivers never got close to anybody. Because you had to deal with the reality. If you lost them, the aftermath of it was so difficult. And that's why everyone was isolated, because you try to insulate yourself from that horrible side of the actual job.
Yeah. Colin Chapman's a real hero in the book at Lotus. And 2 months after Villeneuve's death, Ricardo Pilati dies. And this is a terrible season too in the space of 2 months. And Colin Chapman at Lotus, you, I suppose you want to see what's happened and is he okay? And he grabs you and says, Nigel, you're not seeing this. You're not going near the crash.
Yeah.
You don't need that in your psyche. He understood certainly the toll this was taking on drivers.
Yeah, he was a most brilliant man. And, he had just come from the scene and obviously had seen what had happened. And, you know, saw me coming down and he just totally grabbed me in a headlock and just dragged me off to the side and just put his arms around me and hugged me and just said, you know, you got to come with me, you're not seeing this, you know, stay away.
What do you say, or what do you like, at your most angry in all of this?
I was annoyed at the weekend when they came back, because regardless if it's their fault or not, I think that they should come out. They need to recognise that there was a problem there, they need to apologise, and there needs to be a cooling off period. And the anti-doping structure should be set up that when they are training, that the rest of the world needs to have confidence that the athletes that are going to be coming out of there now are clean.
Sure, how's that ever going
to
happen?
But that's the thing, they shouldn't be left back otherwise, like, because it's a complete epidemic. I don't know, has 30 people after being done, and it's like, if I have to look at it on a negative point of view, I would drive myself bananas. But my mind is always like, whether it's back to Beijing when you were asking me there, or back to Sydney, I'm always trying to piece together afterwards, what have I done wrong? How can I get better?
Yeah.
You know, what will I do next year? What will I do? And I'm too busy with trying to do what I can do to focus on the negatives. And if I did, I would go bananas. And my training's too hard anyway.
And do you ever allow yourself to go bananas?
No, I kind of use it to my advantage. I remember racing the 20k in London, and Kinnikin was back. He was on it. He had a 2 or 3 year doping ban.
Yeah.
He was former world record holder, and we had words with each other like during the race. I sat behind him, it was kind of windy, and I can remember thinking, like, who does your man think he's talking to?
As in, he thought, who are you to take advantage of me with the wind, and you're saying, who are you to pump yourself full of dope?
Yeah, and that was it. I can remember just smirking,
God,
and feeling like, you know, I just wanted to, I felt like Vinnie Jones in the Mean Machine. I wanted to hop him off the barrier on the course, and then he said, no, relax, and I just smiled at him and nodded, and I was like, oh, I'll stay here for as long as I want.
Yeah.
And when I go, and I used it that way, and it was like, you know, you're dirty, you're panicking when I'm next to you, and I feel stronger. And I suppose what summed it up, I remember coming home from Moscow and walking Cahill to school one day, and the fellow who was in fourth place is after getting a life ban now, Air Yorkin.
Yeah.
And he's done me for medals before. I was in a European Cup back in 2006. And he kicked for home, and I ended up behind two fellas, just missed out on another medal, missed out medals and met. So I've had a load of experiences of just missing out on the medals. Like.
Yeah.
And I said to Kyle, he goes, remember the fellow who was fourth, Kyle? And he goes,
this is your son, Kyle?
Yeah. And I said, he's after getting banned for life now for doping. And Kyle turned around and he goes, jeez, Dad, he was on drugs and you still beat him. And I say, do you know, his mind was...
Hmm.
And he says, yeah, and it's a good, because it motivates you.
Can I flip the other side of that coin? How is Rob Heffernan cleanly beating dopers?
Because I can only pull out one of them performances a year. You know, like, I have to periodise my training all year, a little, and my training's incremental. I have to rest, right? But these fellas can come out, they'll race in March, they'll race again, whereas I have won.
Okay.
And then I'm spent there for it.
It's funny,
so I think if you can get, especially for an endurance event like that, if you can get to the point where you can get all of the work done without getting injured or getting sick, and if you're really smart about it, you can get to the start line as good. But they obviously have a massive advantage, like, the recovery and...
Yeah,
they're just able to train so hard because they can recover more.
Well, that ties in with Martin Irvine was in the studio
right.
a couple of weeks ago. Very interesting guy. And he was saying similar things. He can empty himself and beat these guys in certain one-off situations, but they're fine 2 weeks later.
Yeah.
And he's still recovering. Do you worry? I mean, you don't have time to worry, I guess, but it must cast certain aspersion on you that the sport is so rife with it and you're doing really well in the sport. Do you think people are looking at
oh,
you?
Oh, yeah.
Like, your answer there is very convincing and I understand the science behind it, but people who just pay a passing interest to it come Olympic time, how is this Irish lad beating the dopers? That's not right.
Yeah, but if you go back, like, you'd have rumours and it's very, very upsetting, you know?
Is it?
Very upsetting. Like, a good friend of mine who I grew up with asked me after London, was I doping? And it was one of the most hurtful things that was ever said to me in all of my life.
How did he say it to you?
He just said, we were out one night in a few drinks and he was like, you know, you were saying that time, you know, you never thought it would be possible. And, you know, and I was kind of taken aback. And it was only the next day when I thought about it. And it was like a dagger in my heart, like. And then you'd always have rumours, or somebody would say, like, a newspaper person rang me up last year and he says, oh, there's rumours going around about you that there was stories an Irish fella failed a doping test and that the samples were swapped in the lab and somebody snuck into the lab and swapped the sample and that it could have been you or another high profile Irish athlete to protect the name. It's ridiculous stuff.